this hour on Behind the Headlines. The slate of Republicans who want to be Utah's next attorney general gathered for their first and only public debate this week. What did they say? And who will emerge as the top three contenders who move on to the governor? An independent commission looked at the salaries of Utah's top officials and concluded a double-digit pay raise is in order. How are lawmakers reacting? And how will proponents sell a salary bump to the public? And the Mormon Church issued a statement this week attributing its past priesthood ban for blacks on culture. How does the revision sit with church members, and what does it mean doctrinally? Plus, Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. All that and your calls. What news stories are on your mind this week? Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a week in review show, Utah style. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, first charges are filed in the scandal swirling around the attorney general. The same week that candidates vying to replace John Swallow make their case for the office. The Mormon Church revises the reasons behind its previous priesthood prohibition for blacks. Officials argue elected officers need a pay hike, and many more stories are on the docket. All that plus Tribune columnist Robert Kirby later in the show. And you can join us if you like. What's your reaction to the church statement? Who is impressing you among the AG candidates? And do you think the state's high office holders deserve a salary bump? You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. Also submit comments at sltrib.com or call us live 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. On today's panel, Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, who covers state government. Robert, welcome back.
Thank you.
Also with us is religion writer Peggy Fletcher Stack. And Peggy, great to have you here.
Thanks.
And from the opinion page, editorial writer George Pyle, also in the studio. George, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And again, if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. You can also put comments at sltrib.com or send them to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and on Google+. Let's start with the bombshell story. The headline in this morning's paper, Shirtless Fixer is charged. Tim Lawson has been charged with six felony counts filed by Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill and Davis County Attorney Troy Rawlings. And before we get into the specifics, Robert, briefly remind us who Lawson is and what is his connection with former Attorneys General Mark Shurtleff and John Swallow.
Right. Well, Tim and Mark met, I think it was in 2000, when Tim was running this sort of dark horse candidacy for governor. Sort of trying to take on the establishment. And Mark Shurtleff was at the time campaigning for AG. And so they met and they formed a friendship, and it survived over the years. By 2007, 2008 timeframe, Tim was doing pretty intensive fundraising for Mark. He was connecting him with some of these, they call them biz ops, you know, coaching services and so forth that were bringing in tens of thousands of dollars to Mark's campaign. It appears from emails he also made an introduction to Jeremy Johnson, who obviously comes up later in this story. And so Tim and Mark sort of formed this this friendship, and Tim did a lot of fundraising for him. And the problem began to arise when Tim was beginning to represent him, tell people that he had influence with Mark. And could, you know, help them with any problems that they might be having in the office. The issue that led to the charges was, you know, he had allegedly told Mark Sessions Jensen, who was facing some fraud charges in the office, that he had influence with Mark and could help him, get a more lenient sentence. Later, after the plea bargain was in place, Mark Jensen paid him about $120,000 over the next 11 months. So, this becomes an issue where you have somebody who has access to the attorney general, sort of selling that access, for profit. And so that led up to the charges that were filed yesterday.
Okay, and six felony counts. Tick through those, if you would.
Yeah, two of them are obstruction of justice charges that he lied to state and federal investigators. There are two tax violations that he didn't pay taxes on the income he received from Mark Jensen. There's a charge of intimidating witnesses. There were two individuals who. In one instance, it was somebody, since he was working for Mark Jensen, it was an individual who had said that he lost money to Mark Jensen and was trying to recoup that money, and Tim made some threats and hostile statements, I guess, to that person. The other one was an individual who was trying to recover some money that they had lost to a former business associate of Jensen's, a guy named Mark Robbins, and Tim had rather colorfully, I guess, said that he had Polynesian friends who liked to bust people up, and that he always carried a gun, and you know, made these suggestions that if he didn't back down on Robbins, that that this gentleman Darryl McBride would end up going to jail or would be in a world of hurt. So that was the intimidating witness charge. There's also sort of an overarching one, a pattern of unlawful activity, which is sort of the state equivalent of the racketeering statute, which means that he was part of an enterprise, and that one is one that kind of going forward is going to be, I think, significant, because it implies that there are other people involved in what Tim Lawson was doing, and you. When you read through the charges, it doesn't take long to kind of figure out who those people might be. All told, the two of the charges carry an up to 15-year sentence. The other four are 5 years apiece.
Hmm. As a Polynesian, I've been known to bust people up. Anyway, he's described Lawson as a friend and a fixer to Shurtleff, and he, on occasion, compared himself to Porter Rockwell. And Peggy, maybe you can explain this reference. Who is Porter Rockwell?
Goodness. Porter Rockwell is a figure from Mormon history who was a close colleague of Mormon founder Joseph Smith, who there's some allegations that he tried to assassinate the governor of
Missouri.
So he's a rough character.
Okay.
Yep. I guess for people out there who are trying to put all the pieces to this puzzle together, because there are a lot of characters, but what you're saying is that Lawson seems to be connected to all of these different people that in the scandal that's been unfolding this
right.
whole year.
In the charges yesterday, in addition to the connections that he had with Mark Shurtleff through the fundraising and so forth, the charges laid out that he also had these connections to John Swallow. They apparently, I guess I'm extrapolating here a little bit, but got phone records from Swallow and Lawson and saw 680 text messages, phone calls over a period of about 4 years.
Now Swallow's attorney is disputing that, right?
Swallow's attorney says he doubts that they were that much. The phone calls and texts, according to the charges, continued into September of this year. They were discussing things like the ongoing investigation, whether Lawson's phone was tapped, the upcoming, at that time, 2012 election. So the charges sort of paint a picture not only of a close relationship with Shurtleff, but also with Swallow.
George, what do you make of the Lawson allegations, the charges?
Well, this just makes those of us who were suspicious of the whole enterprise feel like we were right, which isn't necessarily something you want to be proven right about. But it just seems that throughout John Swallow's candidacy and his tenure in the Attorney General's office back to his predecessor and mentor, Mark Shurtleff, I mean, now it's being described sort of indirectly as a criminal enterprise. People threatening each other, bribing each other, shaking each other down, involved in some of the businesses that, you know, they become close friends and trade a lot of money with people in the kinds of businesses that attorney general's offices are usually cracking down on. These charges make those of us who thought that John Swallow was always a bad idea in the attorney general's office feel vindicated. Not that there's any pride in that, but that just seems to be the way it's going, and we're looking for more charges. The House Investigative Committee is going to have some more information for us next week, I think.
Yeah, Thursday and Friday.
So it just keeps piling up.
Now, Sim Gill, I understand, is very clear. These are charges against Tim Lawson.
Right, right. The charges stem from sort of an investigation that's been going on from, as near as we can tell, for almost 2 years at this point, easily over a year. But the investigation, as they said, is not just into Tim Lawson. It's into all of the allegations of misconduct, alleged misconduct involving the Attorney General's office and Mark Shurtleff and John Swallow.
So he's not implicating
others.
John Swallow yet,
This is just the first set of charges that came out of that larger investigation. Yeah, and so it's not. I think what Sim was getting at was that you shouldn't extrapolate that because we've charged Tim Lawson, there will be charges against Mark Shurtleff or John Swallow, but he also doesn't close the door to the possibility. He said the investigation's ongoing. They have a large amount of evidence that they're reviewing. They still have a ways to go in this investigation.
Hmm. You will be busy for the foreseeable future. Meanwhile, yeah. A candidates forum for those who have applied to replace Swallow was held this week in Davis County. Is it now seven candidates?
There are seven candidates left. There were nine originally that filed, but two have dropped out of the race.
Okay, give us the slate. Who are the names?
The slate is, we've got Scott Burns, who's a former Iron County attorney. He's and deputy White House drug czar. Michelle Mumford, who's an assistant dean of admissions at BYU. Brian Tarbert, who's the current acting attorney general and is a former adjutant general of the National Guard. Brett Rawson, who's a defense attorney, who's worked extensively for the Fraternal Order of Police and a reserve police officer. Rob Smith, who runs a religious institute for law down at BYU. And Michael Wilkins, who's a former Utah Supreme Court justice. So those are the seven. The way it's going to play out now is on Saturday, tomorrow, the members of the State Central Committee for the Republican Party, which is 181 members, they're sort of county chairs, precinct chairs, and other, you know, elected officials, will be meeting down in Sandy, and they'll choose three of those seven, and they'll send those three names to the governor, who will then pick the one that would ultimately replace John Swallow and fill that position until 2014, when they have another election in November of 2014.
It's interesting. I mean, the debate that was held this week is really the only chance for members of the public, for political insiders, to get a glimpse of how these people think. So what were the prevailing themes during this debate?
Well, there seemed to be a unanimous sense that there needs to be action taken to sort of shore up the office, to improve morale, to restore the public trust. Some people called it cleaning house. They had different opinions about how they should go about doing that. Some people, you know, Sean Reyes, for example, said he wants to fire all the top senior appointees and do audits of the staff. And Justice Wilkins, for example, said that for an office that's gone through what it's gone through, to immediately come in and start auditing things might just hurt morale even more. So that was sort of the overarching theme. And they're largely politically aligned, as you might expect from a group of Republican candidates. There's not broad diversity of political views. They all supported Utah's ban on same-sex marriage. They supported the effort to try to demand the federal government return federal lands to Utah. And so there was a lot of unanimity, I guess, in those viewpoints. So really, I think, you know, behind the scenes, they're out there trying to meet. I mean, it's 181 people. They've had 2 weeks to do it. I think they're out there trying to talk to and meet with as many of these people as they can. And then, you know, they'll give their speech on Saturday that maybe they think will push them over the top. So it's very much a grassroots, on the ground, boots on the ground kind of campaign.
All right. The GOP committee, again, meeting tomorrow to select three names to send to the governor. George, if you're a betting man, who will be on that list?
Well, my reputation as a betting man is pretty bad, but I know who I think should be on that list.
All right.
I think that the Tarbert, the adjutant general, the ex-adjutant general who's now running the office, and the ex-Supreme Court justice are both candidates who have pledged to just come in, be, I think caretaker is maybe too weak a word, but to just run the office until the next election, and they will not themselves seek office. They will not run for the office on their own. And I think that's important, as our editorial said this morning, because if that's not what the next interim attorney general does, then one day he'll take the oath of office, and the next day he will be absolutely required, by the way things work, and it's no reflection on their character, to go out there and start raising money. I mean, if they want to run for election to attorney general next year, they've got very little time. They've got to set up an organization. They've got to start raising money. They've got to set up county chairs and precinct chairs and all these other things. That's going to take a lot of time away from them actually running the office of attorney general. And the whole campaign finance mess is how we got into this problem in the first place. And the last thing we need is a brand new attorney general who's out there on the hustings saying, give me money.
With the, I should mention that I forgot to mention one of the candidates, Sean Reyes, who lost to John Swallow in the Republican primary last year, is also in the field. But as George mentioned, there's, you know, there are the two, Michael Wilkins and Brian Tarbert, who said they won't run again. Scott Burns is sort of on the fence. He said he's not ruling out running. If people want him to run, they think he does a good job, then he'll run. If not, then he won't. So.
And has the governor said when he's going to make an appointment?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the governor doesn't the governor has said that he's going to appoint the best person, and he's going to take some I think it's reasonable to expect that the governor will take some time to vet these three candidates after they're sent to him. I don't think we're going to see an appointment come Saturday afternoon. And so that may take a considerable amount of time. Governor Herbert has in the past shown himself to be pretty cautious in making these sorts of selections, and I think it will probably be a period of time. We'll probably have maybe even weeks before we see an appointment made.
Speaking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, also with us in the studio is editorial writer George Pyle and reporter Peggy Fletcher-Stack. We're talking about the week's top local stories here on Behind the Headlines. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. You can also send comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+, or put them in the comment section at sltrib.com. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, a review of the week's top local stories. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce of the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me this hour, Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, Peggy Fletcher-Stack, and editorial writer George Pyle talking about the week's news. And we're taking your calls as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. That's 801-355-8255. Or you can put questions in the to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+, or in the comment section at sltrib.com. Here's a question from Utah Cannabis Coalition, I think, on Twitter. Do you all think Shurtleff will be next? George, what do you think?
Well, that's kind of what you expect from this. I mean, the comments on the comment board this morning on Robert's story are anticipating that Mr. Lawson will now be expected to roll over on Shurtleff and or Swallow. This is often what happens. You charge somebody and you have evidence against somebody. I'm not saying it's happened in this case, because I have no inside knowledge of it, but I've covered enough political scandals and garden variety crimes in my life to know that you nail one person and you offer them reduced charges or a lesser sentence if they will roll over on the other people that they're involved with. And so that's just the speculation based not really on knowledge of this case, but based on knowledge of the way these things tend to work. So someone's indicted, someone's charged, and then the hope has got to be among the prosecutors, in order to make this person's life easier, he will start making other people's lives more difficult. And this is the old Joseph Wambaugh line, where he said, "We don't solve crimes, we collect clues and hope somebody confesses." Well, it's time for people to start confessing and bringing other people with them.
Again, you can put your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+, or at our page, sltrib.com. I want to move on to one of the big stories this week was on Mormons and race. On Wednesday, the LDS Church put a statement on its website titled, titled Race and the Priesthood. Peggy, what does that statement say? Just give us sort of the main bullet points.
The main points are that the church's more than a century long prohibition against black men holding the churches, being ordained to the LDS church's priesthood, was more of a function of the racial issues of the time and less a divine mandate. And then it strongly disavowed any of the theories that had grown up in to defend the practice, theories like the fact that blacks were descendants of Cain, the biblical Cain, had a black skin as a curse for that, or that they somehow were less valiant in a pre-mortal existence. These were mostly theories that came from, so the statement says, that came from sort of defenses of slavery and defenses of general racial discrimination that seeped into the LDS church. And then, so main point is that the church said this was Brigham Young, the second church president, was influenced by racial discrimination in his environment, that the discrimination did not start with Mormon founder Joseph Smith. It started with Brigham Young, who was the second church president, and lastly, that it disavowed all of those justifications and came out strongly condemning any and all forms of racism.
So all these various theories that have been going through the years, they're trying to shut that down. So, you know, no more ambiguity. This started as a result of cultural context in
exactly.
Brigham Young's time. So because the priesthood is so central to the faith, what did that mean for blacks in a practical sense, having that ban?
Well, it's very different than other faiths because the Mormon Church has a lay clergy, which means every male 12 and up, it has the potential to be a priest in the church, which so that blocked an entire race of people from being allowed males to be ordained to the priesthood. It also meant that black women were not allowed into the faith's temples to do any of those temple rituals. So it had a profound impact on the makeup of the church and on this population and on the history of the church, and it touched pretty much almost every aspect of church life. So that doesn't mean, and they make clear in the statement, that there were black members all that time, people who were baptized, who participated in weekly services, etc. So there were some black members who were devout Mormons throughout this history.
But and it's interesting. I mean, the statement is not like very short. It's almost like a historical thesis. You've been reporting, talking to people, getting reaction. What did the faithful think about this? Do you have a sense from the people that you've talked to or on the website?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about it. I think that for historians or members who were familiar with this history, this is not big news, but the big news is that the church is publicly acknowledging it in an official statement. For church members, and particularly black Mormons, some of them wanted the church to go farther in its statement to include an apology for the past discrimination. But for all members, it creates a bit of a problem if you believe, as Mormons do, that God is speaking to the church prophet every day or often, and that God would not allow a prophet to do something so wrong or disconnected from church teachings. So what does that mean if cultural racial ideas seeped into the church via a prophet? So it's created, as one of my sources, Richard Bushman, who's a biographer and a historian, a preeminent Mormon historian, said, it's going to make Mormons reorient their thinking and have to really say, how involved is God in the day-to-day running, and how do mistakes happen? And a lot of soul-searching, I think, is the outgrowth of this statement.
And at the start of a lot of doctrinal discussions. Robert?
Peggy, I just wanted to ask, one of the things that struck me when I was reading the statement was it focuses on the origins of the policy. And it doesn't really, you know, you jump forward 100 years. I mean, the policy was in effect until 1978. Mm-hmm. And so talk a little bit about how they addressed that issue, how it was perpetuated for over 100 years and out of slavery, but into past the civil rights era and so forth.
Well, I think, yeah, they do mention because in 1852 Brigham Young announced it as a policy, and then subsequent leaders defended it, and they came to believe that it would take a revelation, a divine revelation, to overturn it. And so so all the presidents of the church from 1852 on had to wrestle with this. And so it wasn't until 1978 that they felt that a church president felt he received instructions to overturn it. Yeah.
So it just kind of got carried forward as a tradition almost, or not a tradition, obviously, a doctrinal edict, I guess. But
it became that. It sort of morphed into something that many people believed was a kind of doctrine. I mean, one of the criticisms people have said is the statement talks about these justifications as theories, but many Mormons believed them as doctrines or beliefs. Even so, the words this statement, this article on LDS.org is very carefully worded, and every word is being measured, and that's what people are trying to unpack about it.
It's interesting. I mean, it comes 35 years after the 1978 revelation that blacks could receive the priesthood. Now, George, is there anything that strikes you about the timing of this statement?
Well, I'm not sure why they came up with it now. Obviously, they've had to do a great deal of soul searching, and also they have to consider what the public impact of this is going to be.
And what will it be?
And
what do you think?
I have no idea, because it is in a way they're admitting that their prophet, who supposedly is in contact with God, can have that communication jammed by what's going on around him. And if you're standing in the middle of a bunch of racists, as anybody who lived in America in the 1850s to 1950s was, and then if you want to go along to get along, you're not going to be have a lot of success standing up and saying, well, I'm in direct contact with God, and God says blacks are equal to whites, and you're not going to get very far in the America of that era. But, I mean, you know, the secular version is kind of like the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, read the Constitution, came up with Plessy versus Ferguson and Dred Scott, that blacks weren't equal or that separate was equal. And then the Supreme Court read the very same Constitution in Brown versus the Board and decided that separate wasn't equal. The Supreme Court follows the election returns, Mr. Dooley used to say. Maybe the LDS Church does, too.
This makes it complicated. Here's a comment on our website, sltrib.com, Dwayne Anderson, linking from a passage from the Book of Mormon that directly says that, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but that it has to do with the skin of blackness coming upon people who did not adhere to commandments. And he says, when Mormons say they've disavowed the theories advanced in the past that black skin is a sign of divine disfavor or curse, they're flat out lying. So again, I think this will spur a lot of conversation, not only about race, but about divine intervention and what revelation really means. I mean, do you anticipate that in Sunday school discussions throughout Utah and the world, Peggy?
Possibly. I mean, again, what you have is a statement on a website, not announced at church, not announced in LDS General Conference, discussed on social media and in the media, but how much that filters down to average members in the pew, I'm not sure whether they will. I do want to say, though, that I think that those Black Mormons and activists who've been pushing for this disavowal are cheering today. I mean, they're, and even several of the non-Mormon historians have praised this statement and said, this is a giant step forward. And it took a lot of courage to sort of admit or acknowledge some of its own history, and they should be praised for those things. Yes, there's still questions about Mormon scripture and racial issues, but it's a, for many people, kind of a big step forward.
Well, it's always hard to admit you've made a mistake, and the higher you are in any hierarchy, secular or religious, the more difficult it is to admit that you or your institution has made a mistake, because then you open yourself to charges of, well, what else have you made a mistake on? And it's got to be a rough go for anybody.
Mm. You can find a lot more detail in Peggy's story on sltrib.com. I want to move quickly to another of this week's top stories on a pay hike for elected officials. This committee is recommending a pay boost for all statewide offices. So we're talking the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, auditor, and treasurer. Robert, how big of a pay raise are we talking about?
Well, it pencils out to about 36.5%. So it's
36.5%.
I know, and it's. I think maybe I'm going to run for office now. right now, the governor's getting. I think it's about $109,000 a year. This would suggest raising it to $150,000 a year. And the rationale is that we haven't, well, for one, they haven't raised the governor's or any of the elected statewide elected official salaries for about 10 years. And the other is that, you know, right now the governor is one of the lower paid people in state government, in the upper tier of state government, when we're talking about department heads or people, you know, the people in his cabinet or in his direct office. And so they would like to kind of remedy that. Because all of the other salaries are fixed to the governor's, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, auditor, and treasurer all get 95% of the governor's salary. They would also go up, I'm blanking on the number, I think it's about $130,000 if my math is right. So you know, it's a discussion they're going to have. The same panel made the same recommendation last year, and the legislature didn't adopt it. So it's really ultimately going to be up to the legislature to decide whether or not they're going to do this. The panel said, well, you can phase it in over a number of years if you want. You can post-date it, so, you know, so the current governor isn't necessarily going to be the guy getting it, but whoever wins the next election might be. So, you know, it's a discussion they're going to have, but I think it kind of, when people saw the number, they were like, holy cow, you know, like you did, you know, 37%, that's huge. And especially when you have state employees who've gone for a number of years and seen no pay raises, or in the last year seen minor, you know, incremental pay raises. So it's a debate they're going to have, and, you know.
So what do you think? I mean, how are lawmakers, are they warming up to the idea this time around, or not so much?
Well, I think what they're looking for is some indication from the governor or the, you know, from the elected officials that they would like to see, you know, that they would like the pay raise, you know. I mean, for example, you know, there were sort of oblique references to the John Swallow matter where, you know, he took a pay cut to go from chief deputy attorney general to being attorney general. And then, you know, and then there was the issue when he was chief deputy, he was still apparently making some income on the side through consulting and so forth. They don't want that to happen. Now, obviously, with these elected officials, that sort of side consulting is strictly prohibited. So that's not an issue right now. But they want to make it so it's not so you don't have to be wealthy, independently wealthy, to run for office. You know, you end up with people who are able to, I don't want to say able to live on $109,000 or $110,000 a year, but who are financially well enough off that they can, you know, take leaves from their work, or, you know, you're not going to have people who are working 9-to-5s kind of going and running a campaign, taking a year off to run a campaign and then getting elected to a $100,000 job. So it'll be a discussion that they're going to have, and maybe with the economy turning around a little bit, that, you know, there might be a little bit of extra money. It comes to about $250,000 to pay these five office holders that amount of money per year. So
okay, here's on Twitter, Jeremy Roberts: it would be a better use of funds to give legislators a budget to communicate with their constituents during the session. So that's Jeremy's vote for putting $250,000 in that pot. George Pyle, I mean, the justification is they haven't had a raise for 10 years. It's keeping good people out of the races. is it time? Is it time to give these folks a raise?
Well, we haven't really discussed it on the editorial board. I kind of doubt that we would support this. It's just symbolic is the problem with it. State employees, most people out in the private sector, you know, 37% raise, even though they haven't had one for a long time. That just doesn't happen in the real world. It's not that much money as a portion of the state budget. It's not like you could go out and build a highway or build a school with the money instead. It's not that much. And, you know, that's enough money for most people to live on with a family, $100,000, $109,000. A very interesting comment about how in the private sector, one of the reasons you raise someone's salary is so they won't leave you and go to another job. And they said, well, nobody's going to quit being governor of Utah to go be governor of Colorado for more money. That's just not the way it works. And, yeah, it's been a long time since they've had a raise. And there is the question of whether we're limiting our pool of applicants by this low salary. But even with that increase, I mean, we're not talking about $100,000 to $500,000. We're still talking people who are in an area where they probably are in the private sector. If they have a chance of being elected governor particularly, they'll probably demand a lot more money than that in the private sector, and they're already willing to take a pay cut to perform that public service. Mm.
By way of comparison, the median salary in Utah is about $38,000, and so you can kind of get an idea of where those salaries fall in the larger scheme of things.
It'll be an interesting story to watch. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, also with us Peggy Fletcher Stack, and editorial writer George Pyle. We're talking about the big local news stories of this week, and we need to take another break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines again. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me in studio, Salt Lake Tribune reporters Peggy Fletcher Stack and Robert Gerke, along with editorial writer George Pyle. And we've come to the point of our show where I asked the panel for a story that they think got underplayed this week, one that will become more of a talker as time goes on. Peggy, 30 seconds, quick. What's your story?
Mormon missionaries who come home early from their missions and the stigma they face and the feelings of failure. 73% say they feel like a failure. What is the church going to do about that?
That's going to be a huge story as time goes on. And the ranks of missionaries continue to balloon. A great story at sltrib.com. George Pyle, what's your pick?
All four members of the Utah congressional delegation voted for the budget fix, which may mean no more shutdowns and no more games of chicken for at least a couple of years.
Really? For 2 years?
Maybe. We could pray.
All right, George. Robert Gerke, what do you think?
Well, I think if you didn't get to see it this past week, Matt Piper wrote a really nice story about former Ute football player Bronzell Miller and his sort of last days. He's been diagnosed with cancer, and he's not expected to live much longer. It's a really touching story. And I remember as a Utah man, as we discussed last week, I remember watching Bronzell playing. Was a big fan of his, so it was tough story to read. So take a look at that one. And then, next week, I guess we'll have more on the Attorney General with the House report coming out.
Robert, you have to come back on the radio again.
Always happy to do it.
My pick for the story that got underplayed, but I think is going to play out more in the weeks to come, West Valley Police Department probe. The new police chief is going to audit every case filed over the last year. I mean, this is pretty gutsy on the part of a new police chief. I think we're going to hear a lot more about that. Salt Lake Tribune reporters Peggy Fletcher Stack, Robert Gerke, editorial writer George Pyle, thank you all very much for your time today.
Thanks.
I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And we're going to wrap up this hour with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. And this week we talk about a column that he wrote in 2002 about his wife's cancer.
We go through life believing that we have most everything figured out or accounted for, or we're prepared for just about anything. But the truth is that life plays by a different set of rules than the ones we're often playing by. And so when my wife went in for a routine colonoscopy in 2002, I just made fun of her all the way to the hospital because I'd had one before. And 20 minutes later, we found out that she had stage 3 colon cancer, and it was a huge shock. And there was some speculation that her odds weren't very good. And 8 hours after the colonoscopy, she was in surgery, bowel resection and a bunch of other stuff. And suddenly we were there staring down the barrels of chemo and radiation. And you learn a lot about yourself in situations like that. The one thing that I learned was just how helpless I really was. This is not something you negotiate with. Mm. You just get through it.
You write a little bit about that helplessness in the column, of course, putting a little bit of humor in there as a coping mechanism. Maybe you can read a little bit there.
One of the earliest lessons for me was how much my wife contributed to my life. Things that I had taken for granted over years of marriage that, you know, she was holding up. A week after the surgery, I opened my dresser drawers and honestly thought someone had killed the sock fairy. I'm learning that the washing machine does not turn itself on. Our oldest daughter had to come over and pay the bills. I have the money. What I don't have is clue one how it gets spread around every month. I signed 40 checks and I have no idea what they were for. Did you know that dogs have to be fed every day? Or that you have to put milk back in the refrigerator if you want it to stay cold? Over the years, Irene took care of a lot of other important stuff, including what to do whenever I got fired, what I should say whenever I got pulled over, and how to help me write sincere letters of apology.
Clearly, this was a wake-up call.
It was. And we got really lucky. I'd like to say that it was a miracle, but that sort of flies in the face of other people who weren't so fortunate. And so I don't use the word miracle, I use the word luck, because a lot of the people that we shared these chemo and radiation visits with did not make it. And we got to be friends with them while we were doing this, and it was horrifying for me to have to worry that that might happen to us. But we did get lucky, and she survived, and we're in full remission now.
You say that this is a column that has generated a lot of attention and feedback. What kind of comments were you getting on this column?
I heard from a lot of cancer survivors, but I also heard from people who lost family members to cancer and corresponded with a lot of them about the helplessness that you feel. There's a lot of attention given to the people who are suffering from cancer, and deservedly so. But the people who have to stand there and watch chemo and radiation sort of eat them alive, there's not a lot said about them and their needs. And there were times, because I was working from home and I was her primary caregiver, there were times when I had to go in and touch her to see if she was still alive. And that left a mark on me that'll never go away.
Even a decade after, this seems pretty fresh for you.
Yeah, it does. You don't come away from that easily. And there's always this nagging sense of fear that it'll show back up. And so every time she gets sick or whatever, I start stressing. Because it's always there in the back of your mind. You learn how fragile existence really is.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and you can read his columns at sltrib.com. Also hear him unplugged each week here on Behind the Headlines. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support from Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for tuning in. And here I am again, joined with Lisa Karakaburu, the managing editor for the Salt Lake Tribune, encouraging you to go to the phones and support programs like Behind the Headlines and KCPW again to make your tax-deductible contribution, 801-359-5279, 801-359-5279, or go to the website, kcpw.org. Lisa, we've been talking a lot about Behind the Headlines because that's the show that's been going on this hour. We also have started to do some public forums, but a longstanding feature on KCPW is a weekly conversation with Thomas Burr, who is one of our Washington correspondents, sort of filling in what's happening in our nation's capital. And Lisa, Thomas is really exceptional.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things we're most proud about at the Salt Lake Tribune is that despite all the upheaval in the media industry, that we remain committed to having Washington reporting done by our own reporters. And it, you know, I think it only adds to the offering we're able to make Utahns there when we can have Tommy available in other public forums so that people can really get a good idea of what's going on in Washington that has a very direct impact on Utah. So yeah, the success that we have seen with Tommy and his political cornflakes feature, which if you're not familiar with it, there is a daily blog at sltrib.com of the same title that it really includes. It's information packed. Of everything. So try that too.
To support political cornflakes, Behind the Headlines and KCPW, 801-359-5279. Thanks so much.